support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients a solution for failed root canal treated teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The NBA season is well underway. Here to help us weed out the midget squirts and mites from the Shaqs, Kobe's, C-Webs, and Vladdies is Sacramento Bee columnist Scott Howard Cooper. Scott, welcome back to Only a Game.
It's good to be with you again.
Let's start with the obvious question and just get it out of the way. Can Cleveland surprise the world, as Cavaliers forward Darius Miles claims they are about to do?
I don't want to be the one to break Darius's bubble, but like you said, it's very early in the year, and these things, this too shall pass.
What would lead a player to claim that his team is going to surprise the world? I mean, talk about setting yourself up.
Well, I think that they have the potential of a future there because he's going to be a good player. He's going to jump way up from where people were used to seeing him before, and they have an exciting rookie, and they're one of the few teams in the East that can claim to have a center. But I think to answer your question more directly, I'd say it was a great deal of confidence and maybe wishful thinking. He's trying to get the fans in Cleveland hyped up and maybe turn that arena into something other than a library for a change.
Seriously, though, early talk is of the seemingly inevitable battle between the L.A. Lakers and the Sacramento Kings in the Western Conference Final. Will that talk still be current in the spring?
I think the talk will be current between now and then and until the teams play. It's not only that they're clearly the two best teams in the league, but it's the hottest rivalry going, maybe even in all of sports. It's not just the basketball aspects. There's the geographical aspect, two teams from the same state, and they've played in the playoffs three straight years, and they even got in a fight during the preseason, and that's almost unheard of. And it got ugly. It spilled out. It was under one of the tunnels during the game off the court. There's a lot of hard feelings that I think go way beyond just sort of that gamesmanship that you might hear an awful lot. I think that this is one that's going to continue well into the spring.
During the preseason, Shaquille O'Neal referred to the Sacramento Kings as the Sacramento Queens. I wonder if anybody in Sacramento has thought up any trash talk to deliver back.
Oh, a lot. I just can't repeat any of it on your show. It would get your license pulled. To say there's no love loss between the people of Sacramento and the Lakers specifically, and to a certain extent the city of Los Angeles, would be a massive understatement, but especially towards Shaq, Rick Fox, and Phil Jackson. Those are the ones that are especially on top of the lists in the post offices.
In the early going, Dallas, San Antonio, and Seattle appear to be good candidates to prevent a Lakers-Kings showdown in the West. Do you give that any possibility?
Well, certainly among Dallas and San Antonio, the two Texas teams, San Antonio especially, probably gets a little bit of an edge because they do different things well. Mainly they're a better defensive team than Dallas, but I think the Mavericks have proven in the past that they can play with anybody.
Many people predicted last season that the Los Angeles Clippers would have a breakout year. I wonder if the Los Angeles Clippers will ever have a breakout year.
You mean as opposed to them breaking out of town to a new organization? They've had a few jailbreaks over the years.
Yeah, well, they're not exactly alone in that distinction.
But there's been a lot of people wanting to get out. They're a very, very interesting team. They're a team that a lot of people are expecting to make a big jump and get into the playoffs. At the same time, the problem that they're facing is that several of their players are in the last year of their contracts, and they began the season sort of with this sense of, you know, is everybody going to be playing a little bit of selfish ball and trying to run up their stats to get more money, whether from the Clippers or other teams in the summer? And so when you have that specter kind of hanging over you, that's a bad atmosphere to begin a season. Then you go from that, and they've had some injuries, and on top of that, they have a few new players, and including their point guard. So there's that natural transition time that has to take place. I still believe that things are going to be okay, but again, the atmosphere there is everything. Just because the precedent has been set for so many years, they're probably the only organization there that needs to be able to establish that they're willing to do the right things.
This has been fascinating and probably very useful in terms of people who wonder how the NBA is going to come out this year. Should we just skip the Eastern Conference altogether?
Well, the the reason you want to keep the Eastern Conference is because I think it's the one place, much more than the West, that you could have surprises and keep things interesting. I think when you look at the West, you basically have your four top teams that are sort of locked in, and those are the ones we've been talking about: Los Angeles, the Lakers, the Sacramento Kings, the San Antonio Spurs, and the Dallas Mavericks. Maybe you get like a Seattle or a Portland sort of nudging into there, but the East is so incredibly wide open. When you look at the huge jumps made last year by Boston, New Jersey, and Detroit, those are things that just can't happen in the West. And I think you have another chance in the East for a lot more surprises than you would in the West. And that keeps things more interesting. Maybe you get a Cinderella team or something like that. You have teams that could make a big jump, like Washington. Of course, Michael Jordan could be his last year. That'll create even more interest. So that's why you want to keep the East, and plus, you know, batting practice and all that against the West.
At one point last season, the Charlotte Hornets were a favorite to emerge from the East. Do the New Orleans Hornets assume the same mantle?
I think so. Not only that, now there's people showing up to watch them. So the biggest challenge that the Hornets may be facing now is how do they adjust to, you know, noise at their home games. If they can get past that, I think they're in good shape. They're actually my pick to come out of the East. I think they have a lot of things in their favor, one of which is they have that whole uncertainty about Charlotte or not Charlotte is out of the way now. They've landed in New Orleans, and everything is going to be set up there, and that's where they're going to be spending a long time. I think that's a big difference just because players, you know, always had it in their mind about where are we going to live? Do we have to move? What about the families? And all those natural things that everybody else has going through their minds in their jobs. It's only human that it would have affected them as well. You know, they'd show up to an arena that used to draw so well, and it was empty in there.
Scott Howard Cooper is a columnist for the Sacramento Bee. He raps in round ballese from time to time here on Only a Game. Thank you, Scott.
It's good to talk to you.
San Jose State safety and special teams player Neil Parry lost the lower part of his right leg when it was badly broken during a football game two seasons ago. Now Neil Parry is attempting to become the first college football player to use an artificial limb since Texas Tech's Brian Hall kicked with a prosthetic foot back in 1976. From San Jose, Jason Margolis reports.
2 years ago, Neil Parry's life changed. On a kickoff during the third quarter of the October 14th game between San Jose State and the University of Texas El Paso, a teammate was blocked into Parry's right leg, snapping his tibia. Parry's bone severed an artery and a major nerve to his foot. 9 days later, Parry's leg was amputated below the knee. While many people would have been happy just to walk again, Parry told the doctors he wanted to do more.
When they first told me that it was going to be amputated, and after the amputation surgery, they really made it a point to come in and say, oh, you know, everything will be all right, your life will be normal again. And this whole time I'm just like, man, I want to play football, you know. And as soon as I told them, they were like, well, you know, maybe we should think about this and talk about it. And I was like, well, you can talk about it all you want, but I'm going to try to play. And from then on, everybody's really been behind me.
20 surgeries later, Parry is moving closer to his goal. At a recent San Jose State practice, the team works on drills while Parry and his injured teammates rehabilitate on the sideline. Using a specially designed prosthetic leg called a Pathfinder, a device with a springy toe and a small shock absorber in the heel, Parry works on his agility, strength, and speed. Before his injury, he ran a 4.6 40-yard dash. This season, he's been clocked at 4.9 seconds. Parry's roommate, punter Bryce Partridge, says that while Parry serves as an inspiration to his teammates, he's also still just one of the guys.
And Neil, just first time he put on his leg, he started running. It was just amazing. And I don't know, I don't think he's treated too much differently. He lifts just as much as we do. He runs just as much as we do.
Parry usually works out with team trainer Jeb Burns 3 days a week, sprinting, lifting weights, and working on cutting drills. Burns and team physician Dr. Dan Haber are monitoring Parry's progress, and Burns says that he and Haber will decide when Parry is healthy enough to play. Burns says that Parry's unique situation makes that decision only slightly more difficult than it would otherwise be.
Football inherently it's a dangerous sport, and anyone that goes out there on the field of play is putting themselves at risk, and that's the stance that we're taking. And is Neil putting himself at risk? Yes. But so is everyone else out on the you know, field of play. Is he putting himself at an increased risk because of his prosthetic? That's a tough call.
As for Perry, he says he's not worried about re-injury.
Somebody can hit my, you know, prosthetic as much as they want. It's not going to hurt. They can do whatever they want to it. But, I mean, it could come off, but I'm not too worried about it. If it does, I'll just grab it and throw it back on and jog off. You know, it's not going to hurt me any.
Despite his best efforts, in the past few weeks, Perry has experienced a setback. Inflammation of his right knee has sidelined him from practice. Perry says he had hoped to come back on September 28th against the University of Texas El Paso, the team he broke his leg playing against. And he's concerned that time is running out on the Spartans' season.
Yeah, it's a little disappointing. You know, every game that goes by, it's disappointing that I can't play, you know. But sometime this season, I'll be back out there.
Not only does Perry need to be healthy enough to play, but he also has to be good enough to make the lineup. And Perry says he's not looking for charity. He won't be happy just to be a feel-good story. He wants to contribute to the team.
I want to make the first tackle when I'm out there on kickoff. And, you know, when I do play, I want to be playing. And if it is kickoff, I want to play on every kickoff from thereafter, you know. It's not like I'm just going to go out there for one play and say, okay, well, I'm back playing. You know, I want to play every time that my number comes up.
The Spartans end the regular season on November 23rd against Fresno State. If Perry doesn't complete his comeback this season, he still has one more year of eligibility and says he'll keep trying for next year. For Only a Game, I'm Jason Margolis in San Jose, California.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. People who object to soccer because the games are often low-scoring should have been at a recent match in Madagascar, where Adama, Madagascar's champions, defeated Stade Olympique Lemerne by a score of 149-0. While the game was still tied at 0-0, the losing team's coach, Ratsamandresi Ratsarazaka, became upset at a referee's decision and lost his temper. Then, apparently in solidarity with their coach, Stade Olympique Lemerne players kicked the ball into their own goal 149 times. Radio Madagascar has claimed that the result represents a new world record in a first-class match. Actually, I wonder at what point in a run toward 149 goals the match stopped being first class.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Venus Williams advances to the semifinals of the WTA Tour Championships, keeping things on course for an all-Williams final. Read more about the matches at WBUR.org. Click on news and then on sports. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Direct Hire and Auto Service, with locations in Watertown, Norwood, Peabody, and Natick. Information available at 1-800-TIRE-PRO or online at directtire.com. The Nature Conservancy, working to protect the landscapes, forests, and waterways of Massachusetts for future generations, on the web at nature.org. And Persian Gallery on Boylston Street in Boston, committed to excellence in bringing decorative new and antique rugs to furnish homes in New England. PersianGalleryInc.com. It's 7:20.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, attorneys for a Hall of Fame running back claim that he did not put federally protected aquatic mammals in harm's way. But first, Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota is best known for its strong liberal arts program and because the late Senator Paul Wellstone once taught there. But it's also known for a football program that delivers wins only with great difficulty. In today's season finale, the Carleton Knights will try to avoid posting its second straight winless campaign. Over the last couple of years, and for obvious reasons, several dedicated Carleton College students have addressed what they perceive as a marked lack of team spirit. On October 19th, Minnesota Public Radio's Mary Stuckey visited Laird Stadium and witnessed the Knights' 41-7 loss to the University of St. Thomas. But she did get to meet Carlton's vivacious and spirited volunteers, and she prepared this audio portrait.
My name's Dan Farmer. I'm a student at Carlton College. I'm a senior, and I'm the head of the Honkin' Nice Pep Band. I kind of conduct, but it's mostly just dancing and singing and, like, in rhythm. So, yeah, we play music, yeah. We play okay. But, all right, let's go.
And now, the starting lineups for the men in yellow tights.
Woo! Yeah, yellow tights!
Carlton Knights. Hey! On offense, at quarterback for the Knights is number 5, Ben Cooprider.
Bob Cooprider, our son is Ben, number 5, quarterback. I think it's great. It's so much better than a big, formal, big college band. They have so much enthusiasm. It's fun to see them sit there and just so relaxed and do whatever comes to mind. And then in the second half, they get bored and they're reading. And
well, I'm Steve Stigler. I am indeed a Carlton fan, and I think these guys are tremendous. They're one of the best shows on the field, better than the team at the moment.
My name's Peggy Eichton, and I am supporting Carlton because my son is a freshman player. And I love this band. It brings an era of hope amidst the probability of loss.
Hey, if you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. Let's go. If you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. But I'm the instrument.
I'm Judy Lichterman-Mann, class of 74. And I think the Pep Band is fabulous, especially the fact that they don't practice.
There we go.
They have a mind of their own, I tell you. They don't listen to me anymore.
So if you need your reference when I start singing, that means you have to play the instrument. Not necessarily start singing.
I'm Jamie Anthony, and I'm a freshman at Carlton. And they're pretty awesome. I'm glad that we have some spirit, even though the team isn't very good. So the band is why we came.
Hi, I'm Maria Bruin, and I'm also a freshman here at Carlton. And I'm kind of used to having a winning football team, and it's not quite so fun if you lose really bad every time. But I don't know, a lot of people are here, so I see. It seems like it's a good time. So.
Our kickoff thing is playing the kazoo progressively louder in the hopes of annoying the other team. Yes?
I thought we did to symbolize the motion of the ball.
I'm Arijit Guha, a senior at Carlton College. I'm a history major and the leader of the Carlton Cheer Boys. We're the gender-neutral cheer boys when we have women cheering with us. But typically it ends up being just a core group of 4 or 5 guys. Well, the first word I'd use is incompetent.
My name is Chris Brand. I'm the head football coach at Carlton College.
What do you think of the cheer boys and the Pep Band? No?
We show up in our bright yellow Carlton t-shirts and any sort of blue pants. We don't really have much of a uniform per se. We originally started out trying to choreograph. Then we realized that none of us have any sort of skills that would be, you know, useful in trying to dance and choreograph. So pretty much we make sure that the Carlton fans are louder than the opposing team's fans, because a lot of the time what happens is that the Carlton fans will actually be outnumbered by visitors' fans, so we still make that Carlton presence felt. In a school of this size, it's not just these random football players that you don't know, but the people on the football team are your friends, your classmates, the people who live down the hall from you. So, you know, as incompetent as we are, and as ridiculous as it might seem out there, and the real reason we're out here is just to cheer on our friends and show support for our teammates.
And St. Thomas Band! It's a new half! It's a new game! We got another message for you!
Oompa Loompa Loompa Dee Doo! We are going to dominate you!
Harry! Answer your walkie-talkie.
Let's go!
I just tried to call you. You were supposed to do the chicken dance.
Oh, my God. I got to do that.
First down, Tommies.
Pay attention next time.
Go! Oh, my good God. So, Carlton scores first touch on the game. Only in the fourth quarter. The cheer boys just did a lap around the track.
And I'm about to die of asthma attack right now. Oh, wow. And the crowd went crazy. The crowd just went crazy. The final score might not be the greatest, but it was a great game. We had all these fans out here. We had a really fun time in the fourth quarter. We won the fourth quarter 7-0, and the fans were excited all the way throughout. You know what? We come out here to get people excited, to get people in the game, and cheer on our friends. And that's what happened today. So, all in all, it was a good game.
The Carlton Knights will attempt to avoid going 0-10 for the second straight season when they host the Scots of McAllister College this afternoon. The Honking Knights pep band and the gender-neutral cheer boys plan to attend Carlton College basketball games this winter. Camping is fun, or so I'm told. Part of the fun is that it can include physical activities such as hiking, kayaking, and sidestepping hungry bears. And Simon Coe, creator of this week's World Tent Pitching Championships in London, has added a competitive pursuit to that list. Simon Coe joins me now from Earl's Court in London. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks a lot, Bill. It's good to be there.
Simon, could you describe how competitive tent pitching works?
Right. Competitive tent pitching was something we cooked up in the office a while ago to raise the profile of camping as a whole. We organize a caravan and outdoor leisure show at Earl's Court every year. And we were looking for something that would drive attendance and interest in the canvas section of the show. You know, it's an important start. So competitive tent pitching, we decided on teams of two. Mm-hmm. A variety of tents. We've got 2-man, 3-man, 5-man, and 6-man. And the winners overall will be the ones who can put all four tents up in the fastest total time.
I see. So it's pretty much just a case of speed. We're not talking about style or anything like that.
Yeah, there are some rules. You know, the tents have to be pitched to the judges' satisfaction with all the guy ropes and pegs in the right place. Mm-hmm. One member of the team has to be inside a sleeping bag inside the tent.
Just to show that it can be done.
Just to show that it can be done.
All right.
And I think a lot of people's conception of camping in tents is sort of back to Boy Scouts and Girl Guide and sort of Pathfinder group stuff, where, you know, it was a horrible old piece of canvas with some ropey old poles. It would leak like a sieve and take, you know, 2 days to put up in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
But we're out to prove that you can pitch your tent really fast.
I understand that this is the inaugural championship.
It is.
But how fast can one put up, say, a 5-man tent?
Well, we've got the current records for the 2-man is 3 minutes, and that's an Aztec tent. For the 3-man, now this is the impressive one, this is 46 seconds, and that's
wow.
The Cayenne.
Wow.
The 5-man is a Coleman tent, and that's 9 minutes. And the 6-man, and this is a big tent. I mean, it's a seriously big tent. That's 20 minutes.
And that includes the time it takes for somebody to get into a sleeping bag inside the tent.
Yeah, they start from the start line, effectively. The tent's in the bag. They have to sort of run to their pitch, get everything out of the bag, and start from there.
That 46-second endeavor must be something to see.
Yeah, I believe it. I mean, I think you take it out of the bag and it almost does itself, I should think, at that speed. But but that's modern technology being brought to bear into the camping market.
Now, what does one call a competitive tent pitcher? Is there a title for a person who does this?
Well, there hasn't been in the past, so we probably need to think of one. So if you've got any ideas, we'll gladly use them.
Sounds like a ridiculous contest to me.
Well, there are world championships for everything these days. I mean, in England, we have the World Worm Charming Championships.
Worm Charming?
Yep.
We'll get right on it.
Yeah, the Americans are notorious for having world championships and not even inviting anybody else. So, we have invited people from all over the world to take part.
I think that's very good. Much better than the World Series.
Exactly.
How many teams are competing in this event?
Well, we've had four qualifying rounds through the summer in the UK. And we've got 24 finalists who then will, the fastest ones will go through to the actual World Championship playoffs, I suppose you'd call it, on the Sunday, when we add the exciting elements of a wind machine and a rain machine, just to make it a little more realistic.
How serious are the competitors when they're doing this? I mean, are they sort of laughing, or is there no, I mean, do people get tossed off the team for not being serious enough, that sort of thing?
I think inevitably people are taking it seriously. There's a good prize, for instance. You know, it's a holiday for four in the Canadian Rockies. So it's a prize worth winning, and of course the honour of being the inaugural World 10 Pitching Champions, which will always be the best one to win. They are taking it seriously. But like anything to do with the outdoors, there's an element of fun involved.
I have to ask, besides the prize that you mentioned, is there a trophy? I mean, a big bronze tent or something?
The golden mallet.
The golden mallet. Splendid for banging in the tent poles, of course.
Exactly.
Will there be extreme tent pitching at some point? I mean, pitching a tent on the Thames or something like that?
Well, I saw there was extreme ironing now, involving ironing boards.
Absolutely.
So I suppose extreme tent pitching could be the next stage, yeah. We'll do it on the roof next time to make it a little livelier.
Simon Coe is the supreme commander in the sport of tent pitching. Simon, thank you once again for joining us.
Thanks very much, Bill. It was a pleasure.
On Wednesday, a Miami judge ordered the arrest of O.J. Simpson when both Simpson and his attorney missed a court appearance on a charge that the former football star had sped through a manatee zone in a powerboat.
If the manatee wasn't hit, you must acquit.
Mr. Simpson's attorney, Yale Galanter, if that really is his name, maintained that a mix-up in his schedule was responsible for his absence from court. And the warrant was withdrawn later that day.
If the manatee was saved, the penalty must be waived.
Mr. Simpson must decide now whether to pay the $65 fee or contest the charge. He has already entered a not guilty plea, maintaining that there were several other people on the boat, though the officer issuing the ticket saw only Simpson and his girlfriend.
If no manatee was caught in the propeller, then O.J. should be a free fella.
Making an actual appearance in court would not be easy for Simpson, who has vowed to spend his time...
If the sea cow doesn't bleed, then O.J. must be free.
Making an actual
appearance...
Making an actual appearance in court would be difficult, because Mr. Simpson has vowed to spend all his time trying to catch whomever it was that day, speeding through the manatee zone.
If the manatee is okie-dokie, you can't put O.J. in the pokey.
If there is a live sea cow, O.J. is innocent. And how?
O.J. is free.
Peace to the peaceful manatee, wherever she may roam. Used to be that she was free, and the waterways would always be her home. Traveling along the coast for 100 miles or more, doing what she loves the most, like all those ghosts who came this way before.
You're listening to Only a Game. Among the recent emails was one from Ted Harwell, who hears Only a Game on KPBS in San Diego. He wrote, "I understand the East Coast bias, what with two California teams in the World Series and no one on the East Coast watching, but how did you and your sportsperson Pierce manage to talk for 10 minutes and not devote 10 seconds to the series?" Another KPBS listener, Paul Riza, was similarly upset. "I bet if that group of guys in that old park in Boston was playing, there would have been wall-to-wall coverage," he griped. Of the piece Kathleen Adams filed about a new elementary school curriculum, which utilizes facts and figures about the racing industry to educate elementary school students in Lexington, Kentucky, Dale Morden, who hears the program on WHYY in Philadelphia, wrote, "Too bad they don't include betting and handicapping to help reinforce those math skills." Paula Griswold of Cambridge, Massachusetts, was disappointed that we didn't use the Robert Preston version of Trouble from The Music Man out of our billiard story 2 weeks ago. And Kristen McCumber, who hears Only a Game on WBUR in Boston, also wrote to suggest that we had missed a musical opportunity. No piece on the New York Marathon, particularly one where the interviewee is an amputee, should have ended without a few bars of David Buskin and Robin Batteau's Stars in Their Eyes, a song about people coming to Manhattan to achieve their dreams. I wonder if that's the one that goes something like this. They got a convict studying law till dawn. They got a one-legged rider in the marathon. They got a street vendor hustling his merchandise. In the apple, everybody got stars in their eyes. Stars. We'll get your music suggestions and other comments as well if you go to our website, onlyagame.org, and email us from there. Our standard address is onlyagame, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a comment on the listener line at 617-353-1860. Stars, stars, stars. Where they shot his dad. This fruit stand's the biggest thing he ever had. Says his kids will be doctors if it cost his eyes. This is a hell of a place for a star to rise. Stars, stars, stars. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter McLennan and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Energy Star Homes, funded by local gas and electric utilities to help protect the environment through consulting services for builders and buyers of new homes. EnergyStarHomes.com. And Nixon Peabody LLP, providing legal services to local, national, and global businesses with offices in the East and in California. On the web at NixonPeabody.com. All Good Organics Real Food Energy Bars, certified organic on-the-go nutrition that meets FDA Good Source of Fiber standards. Available at Bread and Circus and Stop and Shop. Good morning, I'm Gina Cervetti with these sports headlines. The NFL has fined New England Patriots defensive end Willie McGinnis for roughing up former teammate Drew Bledsoe. McGinnis was fined $7,500 for picking up Bledsoe, throwing him to the ground, and then falling on top of him in last week's game at Buffalo. The Celtics play at Minnesota tonight, and the Bruins skate at Ottawa against Ottawa at the Fleet Center tonight. In college hockey, Harvard beat Dartmouth 5-2. Northeastern skated past Providence 4-3. UMass Lowell lost to New Hampshire 4-3. Meet host Jackie Leiden and learn more about our next Citizens of the World tour at a free reception Thursday, November 14th. To reserve your space, call 800-909-9287.
Deborah Henson-Conant is world famous for her indescribable harp playing. She's been called a combination of Leonard Bernstein, Steven Tyler, and Xena the Warrior Princess. I'm Robin Young. You can see Deborah in a live performance to benefit WBUR this Friday night at 8 at the Regent Theater in Arlington. I'll be joining Deborah on stage for what promises to be a unique reading. Call 781-646-4849 or log on to WBUR.org. Hope to see you there.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, some runners who get their kicks as well as their bunions on Route 66. But first, joining me on the line this week from Greenville, South Carolina, is our analyst, Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill, and hello to our new friends at KSKO in McGrath, Alaska, which, if it was located in Massachusetts, would be pronounced McGraw.
This is probably true. Charlie, Tuesday's elections certainly established a trend. I wonder, however, if you detect a trend within a trend regarding the sports-related candidates.
Well, not really. Steve Largent, you know, NFL Hall of Fame wide receiver and wingnut loony from the right, lost in Oklahoma. Of course, that's only my constitutionally protected opinion. Tom Osborne won, which should be no surprise to anybody. He's performing a lot better this year than his former football team is. But the most intriguing one, of course, is Mitt Romney, our new governor in Only a Game's home field of Massachusetts. Mitt, you may recall, put a shine on the corrupt Salt Lake Olympics, largely by trading international bribery for good old-fashioned American crony capitalism.
The Four Nations Cup is ongoing in Ontario, Charlie. Perhaps it should be renamed the One Nation Cup, given the results. Canada beat the U.S. 7-0 in the opening game. What do you think, the One Nation Cup?
Well, you may be right. Maybe we should just do it among the provinces. And we have the 8 provinces cup. I, for one, would much rather, I think, watch Alberta play Manitoba than watch the Canadians roll over the rest of the four nations.
There is some unrest, though, in Hockey Central. Michael Croteau is suing the New Brunswick Amateur Hockey Association for $200,000 because he claims that his son deserved this year's league MVP award. His son apparently had 97 points to the winner's 60 points, so it sounds like he's got at least a mathematical case.
Oh, this opens up just a terrible Pandora's box here, especially among America's baseball writers. I can imagine people suing each other over all kinds of trophies. You know, Mr. Croteau should go down to the local and have a Labatt's and chill out. I don't think his lawsuit has any merit. Let's face facts. His son's case for MVP has a lot more merit than his case in court to get his son the MVP.
In a perhaps related or soon-to-be-related case, 39-year-old Arizona Diamondback hurler Randy Johnson received his fourth Cy Young Award, but Pedro Martinez did not receive his fourth Cy Young Award. Barry Zito got it in the American League. How do you like those results?
I don't have a real problem with it. I mean, Zito's going to be the controversial one, of course, but the one thing you have to remember about Barry Zito is that In the very, very tightest of situations, teams batted less than 150 against him with runners in scoring position, and he won his last 8 starts in August, essentially carrying that team to their divisional championship. I have no problem with Barry Zito. I'm sorry Pedro Martinez does.
Former Giants manager Dusty Baker will not rejoin the Giants. He is meeting with the Chicago Cubs next week. Dusty, a good match in the Windy City?
I don't think anyone's a good match for that team as long as the Chicago Tribune Company owns the Chicago Cubs. He's going to find himself in the same situation that generations of Boston Bruins coaches have discovered themselves. His owners are not going to allow him the money to compete and win. So I don't know why they couldn't make it happen in San Francisco. I don't know what the San Francisco Giant management was thinking of in squandering an undeniable asset. But with all due respect to Dusty Baker, he's not going to get it done in Chicago.
In another hot stove league story, Bernie Brewer, the Milwaukee Brewers mascot, will apparently get a little air-conditioned room that he can rest in between bursts of antic activity at the Bull Yard. That's quite a perk for a team that says it can't compete because it doesn't have any money.
Now, I don't understand this one. I can understand a little air-conditioned room for the guys who have to wear the funny suits with streamers coming out their artificial noses because they might get a little bit hot during those the dog days of July and August. But Bernie Brewer wears lederhosen, which the last I looked are shorts. And all he's got to do is slide down a slide. Back when I lived in Milwaukee 20 or 30 years ago, Bernie Brewer was a lot tougher, let me tell you.
Kobe Bryant said this week, Charlie, that he would like to play in the 2004 Olympics, and he thinks that he can convince teammate Shaquille O'Neal to accompany him to Athens. Will the inclusion of the two best Lakers guarantee the gold?
I think it will come very, very close. I think one of the problems that the United States had, and let us not forget that this is not only a team that didn't win it, this team didn't finish in the top 5, was that the best players they had weren't there. And I think there's a considerable embarrassment, and I think there's a considerable amount of payback. And if the big Aristotle decides to sign on board, I predict there will be a considerable number of very unhappy international centers.
63-year-old bicyclist Jumber Lajava of Tbilisi, Georgia, this week completed a bicycle ride around the world. The trip took him 9 years. He said, "My trip would be even more successful if there were no more wars on any continent." Maybe it's a good thing that he didn't begin his trip more recently, huh?
Well, you've got to give him credit for having a wonderful take on the thing. You've also got to give him credit for actually pedaling through all those wars. And you have to give him, I think, towering credit for the fact that you leave on your around-the-world bicycle trip from Tbilisi knowing full well that the only way to complete it is to go back to Tbilisi.
University of Nevada at Las Vegas assistant football coach John Jackson will be reprimanded for leaving last Saturday's game while it was still in progress. He needed to go to a boxing match between Johnny Tapia and Marco Antonio Barrera, which he had helped to promote. Come on, can't a lowly state employee augment his income?
This is the kind of moonlighting problem they don't have at, you know, Notre Dame or Columbia or someplace. I guess the university is within its rights to reprimand the guy, but they should lighten up a little bit. I mean, you know, it's not like he was doing something that wasn't intimately involved in the local economy.
Finally, Charlie, an Oregon company has been selling Tanya hot sauce, which it claims is, quote, not for the weak-kneed. Former Olympic figure skater Tanya Harding's attorney said the label portrays her as a cigarette-smoking, bubblegum-chewing trailer trash, and that's not who Tanya is. Charlie?
You know, the American reservoir of shame, which I think exists somewhere in the northwestern corner of Montana, just gets smaller by the day.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and spices things up each week here on Only a Game. Thanks very much, Charlie.
And I was only kidding over there in Tbilisi, by the way.
Should you feel the inclination to send Only a Game a message, learn more about the program, or perhaps listen to the odd Only a Game that you've missed, visit our website, onlyagame.org. Imagine running a marathon. Okay, now imagine running two or more marathons every day for 84 days over dirt and gravel roads and steep mountain passes without adequate food, modern medicines, or even a comfortable place to sleep. That's the challenge that faced nearly 200 runners in 1928 as they set out from Los Angeles on the way to New York on the Great American Foot Race. This extraordinary race and the story of its unlikely winner, 19-year-old Cherokee Indian Andy Payne, is the subject of a new documentary called The Great American Foot Race. Often dubbed the Bunyan Derby, the race began as a joke among highway officials trying to find a way to promote the newly completed U.S. Route 66. But as historian Jerry McClanahan explains in the documentary, it soon became something more.
This was an endurance race. This was pitting man against not the highway, but really nature, against the mountains and the deserts, the thin air at high elevations, the impact of the rock and gravel on the feet. And this was a way of dramatizing how far the country had come as far as being connected.
199 runners set out from Los Angeles with seasoned champions of marathons and even ultramarathons in the ranks. Andy Payne was just a farmer's son from Oklahoma, but he thought he could win. Payne's sister Pauline remembers letters Andy sent from the road.
You know what he said? I'm going to win this race. And he wrote that several times. He said, I've run with all of them. I can beat any of them.
Payne was quickly becoming the most successful Native American athlete since Jim Thorpe, and Pauline, a grade schooler at the time, says her entire school followed the race in the newspapers. When they read that Payne might have to drop out of the race during a bout with tonsillitis, children cried in the schoolyard. It was this part of the adventure, Payne's emerging status as a role model for Native Americans, that led filmmaker Lily Shangro to the story.
One of the things that I noticed in public television is a lack of Native American heroes for our children to look up to and to try to emulate. And Andy's story was just so exciting to me because here was a boy who was a farmer, a poor farmer, and he did this incredible thing, but he used that win to do something even better for himself, which was to go to school. And he worked, and kind of created a small fortune for his family using this sort of leg up on life at a young age when most folks aren't even thinking about what they're going to do tomorrow.
The race was organized by a man named C.C. Pyle, often referred to in the film as Cash and Carry Pyle. He was offered a $60,000 contract from the Route 66 Highway Association to publicize the newly completed road, but he spent much of that money on a personal luxury motor coach, the extravagance of which was not lost on Pauline when the race came through Oklahoma.
Oh, man. It was the fanciest thing you ever saw for that day and age. It had everything. Beds and kitchen and you name it, it had it.
While Pyle rode in luxury, his runners were left wanting for basic necessities. Although they had been promised food and lodging along the way, many of the runners got their best meals, a cup of coffee and a peanut butter sandwich, from the 3,000-gallon Maxwell House coffee pot that accompanied the tour as a promotional gimmick. Shangro describes life on the trail.
At first, they had a kitchen that followed them, but pretty soon, Pyle fired the cook, and so they had somebody who could whip together a stew once in a while. But the men rebelled because the food was so bad. They forced Pyle to pay them a daily sum for meals along the way. And the beds, I hear or I read, that the blankets were washed maybe once and that they were burned in some farther town down the line.
When the runners made it to Oklahoma, Payne's home state, it was quite an event. Family friend Brummett Echohawk remembers.
Oh, my goodness. It's a landslide of people. And they were appearing everywhere along the line. The school children were let out to come down and watch him run. It just passed by. So people along Sepulpa had fried chickens for him and pies and all that, you know. They ran out with their little food boxes, but he couldn't carry them. He was running all the time, so.
Oh, at the time, it was a huge event.
Filmmaker Dan Bigby.
It was a sort of thing that schools actually shut down, as Brummett mentioned, and the kids were brought to the race. Chambers of Commerce all along the way were using it to promote retail sales in the various towns, and so drawing huge crowds was really the whole point. And people had been following the race through the newspaper all along the way, so when Andy, Oklahoma's favorite son, showed up in the lead, it was quite an exciting thing.
Only half of the Bunyaneers made it to the Continental Divide, and just 60 remained when the race left Chicago. Arthur Newton, the world's 100-mile champion, had an 8-hour lead on Andy Payne until he sprained his ankle. Another runner, Arnie Suminen, had a 5-hour lead on Payne in Texas but slipped on an icy road outside Amarillo. Other challengers dropped out after being hit by cars or slipping on loose gravel. Payne's last challenger, Peter Gavussi, a ship steward from England, had a 6.5-hour lead before an abscessed tooth prevented him from eating and forced him to drop out. Still, as Dan Bigby says, Payne's victory was more than just luck.
We had the fortune of visiting with Billy Mills, Olympic gold medalist, and once he learned of some of these details, his comment was, well, that's racing. Those are the sorts of things that a racer, a runner, has to prepare for and be ready for. So was it luck or was Andy the better runner? You'll have to make your own speculation.
Before the race began, C.C. Pyle called the event, quote, the easiest thing he'd ever seen for making money. But along the way, his plans to sell a million programs fell flat. Towns failed to pay for the privilege of having the race stop for the night, and even the Route 66 Highway Association refused to pay Pyle all the money it had promised. When the runners finally made it to New York, it looked as if they'd never be paid their prize money, or even get back the deposits they'd given Pyle for travel back home.
Well, C.C. Pyle was broke. We didn't run across any evidence that he was much of a money manager, and it seemed that as soon as he had money, he spent it without much regard for what would happen later. He was bailed out eventually by millionaire F.F. Gunn and the boxing promoter, famous boxing promoter of the day, Tex Rickard. And I personally speculate that they needed to bail him out so that they could get him out of Madison Square Garden and get on with what they were doing.
The Great American Foot Race was an epic adventure, but in the documentary, Andy Payne's son says that the most important time in his father's life wasn't winning the foot race. It was the 50 years that followed the race, during which Andy Payne paid off the mortgage on his parents' farm, invested successfully in land for his family, put himself through law school, and served 40 years as clerk of the Oklahoma Supreme Court.
That was what attracted us to the story to begin with, was this Indian boy made good. He brought home the $25,000 prize and made something out of it. And that was a lifelong challenge for him. And that's what inspired me.
Brummett Echohawk, Andy Payne's contemporary, couldn't agree more.
He stood up and walked to the window and looked out. And he said something like, a man can't be an athlete all his life, but he can use the same driving force to accomplish his goals. I believe that says everything about his character.
Dan Bigby, a Comanche Indian, and Lily Shangro, a Lakota Indian, produced the Great American Foot Race, airing on public television stations all this month. Produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Tad Curry. We had help this week from WUMB Radio at UMass Boston and from Kelly Burley at KOSU in Stillwater, Oklahoma. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear the program again, sign up for our newsletter, or learn more about the Great American Foot Race, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from O.J. Simpson attorney Lonnie Donegan.
If he didn't scrape the ocean bovine, then everything will be fine.
American jurisprudence, you beauty. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, educating discerning patients and dentists since 1985 about their options for the replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is WBUR. We're